Welcome to the New York Times Popcast, your Let's Be a Safe Space of Music News and Criticism. I'm your host, John Caramonica. Listening to Rage Against the Machine. The reason you're listening to Rage Against the Machine is because Rage was about to embark upon a reunion tour. This is going to start in El Paso. It was running through Coachella and running for the duration of the summer. That tour, along with many other tours, has been either postponed or canceled. I was going to go to opening night of that tour in El Paso to cover it, and that is one of the many things that have changed in the world since the last time that I have checked in with you guys. As you know, the spread of the coronavirus has led to some extreme measures of social distancing, including the cancellation of all gatherings over, depending on where you are, 50 people, some recommendations for 10 people. Potentially by the time you hear this, there will be curfews in place. This is a very unusual situation in the world and in America. And as someone who has always found concerts to be healing spaces and safe spaces, it's pretty jarring. And I'm sure it's jarring for a lot of you as well. On Popcast for this episode and probably the next episode as well, we're going to talk about how things are affected in the world of live music and in the music world more broadly. The first thing that I'm going to talk about is the fact that I am not in the office. No one is in the office. Pedro is recording from his house. We've got some kind of web link thing happening. I bought a USB mic. I feel professional. I look like I'm here doing talk radio in the 1950s. And, you know, you might hear stuff out the window. The audio quality might be, it's going to be verite. It's going to be extremely verite. So if the Mr. Softy truck drives by, it's vibes. Just try to absorb the vibes. This is where we are right now. And Popcast will reflect our new and evolving homebound realities. We're going to continue this way for the foreseeable future. It's a little strange. I'm here. I mean, I have a home office that, as those of you who know me personally know, is curiously underused, but we are going to use it and we are going to take advantage of the space and the quiet. And I'm going to be calling folks up today and for the next episode and talk to them about what's been happening in the last week or two. Today, we're going to start with the business that are happening. Ben Cesario is going to call in and we're going to talk about live tour cancellations, the gig economy when it comes to living on the road and working with musicians, and some of the challenges the music business is going to face in the coming weeks and months. And then later, John Perellis, JP, is going to call in just for a quick expectation setting. JP has seen many eras of pop music come and go and has seen how pop has reacted to any number of crises over the years. So we'll be talking about what we might be expecting from our pop stars and our musicians in the next few months. Also, at some point, probably in between those two conversations, I am, as I said, in my home office. And again, my home office is full of many things: books, magazines, tchotchkes, ephemera, albums, etc., etc. So I think every time that I am going to do an episode from the home office, I think I will identify an item here or a couple of items here and kind of chat about them, give a little bit of perspective of the things that I have chosen to surround myself with over the years. So hopefully that'll be at minimum a good laugh for folks. But first, Ben Cesario is calling in from his home to my home. Ben, how are you holding up first and foremost?
I'm hanging in there, John. It's even crazier than I think we all expected, but
are you washing your hands?
I am washing them so much. It's beyond belief.
Okay, I'm going to get a good moisturizer for you to kind of like tighten that up after, because, you know, you don't want to dry them out. You know, it's something to keep in mind. So, Ben, last week is when we really started to see the beginnings of what has now become normal life in America. Things started getting canceled and big companies who are ordinarily
pretty conservative, I think, in terms of making big economic decisions, sort of forced into a position of having to take big strides. So can you talk a little bit about the kind of TikTok of what happened last week and how the bigger companies, Live Nation, AEG, kind of arrived at the choice to cancel shows?
I think it actually started the week before last, which was when South by Southwest was canceled. And that's an atypical event for the concert industry. It's really like a big conference, but it's really kind of the first event of the live annual calendar for lots of people. And the city of Austin, the health officials there on a Wednesday gave a press conference where they said, you know what, canceling South By is not going to make any of us safer. All systems go. 2 days later, they pulled the plug. That was the first domino. I think that was the one that really made everyone realize just how serious this was and cast eyes in the direction of Coachella. And so within days, Coachella postponed. And then I think it was just a day after that, or maybe it was 2 days after, Live Nation and AEG suspended all of their major tours in the US and I believe on like continental Europe and in some other places. Not the UK, interestingly, because the government there hasn't gone as far as the governments of other places. So like Morrissey just gave a concert there the other day. But essentially, once that happened, we started to see all of the dominoes. Carnegie Hall cancels everything. Venues shut down. Various states and city governments issue all of these orders about limiting crowd size. Broadway closes. So South By, I think, was the first large-scale festival-type public event where this happened. But like in less than a week after that, the entire system shut down.
Okay, so I want to talk about two things. One, the conversations and kind of ethical imperatives that went into the decision-making to initiate these shutdowns. Let's start with that, and then we'll kind of go to the fallout, financial, cultural, etc. South By, as you said, sort of waited on the advice of local health officials. And now this is, of course, there were federal mandates about gatherings and potential curfews being bandied about. This is way before that. Now,
I think there's still a question of whether South By wanted to postpone at all.
Right. And that's my question. Yeah.
We don't know exactly what happened there, but we do know that the health officials were the ones who pulled the plug. There was a order by the county judge that authorized the city, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, when they held this press conference, essentially shutting South By down, no one from the festival was present. The statement from the festival was they were heartbroken to do it. We know that in the days leading up to it, the people running South By were very reluctant to cancel. There's a lot riding on that. And we also know that within a few days after it was canceled, the organizers of South by Southwest said that they did not have the kind of insurance coverage that they would need in this case. They had cancellation insurance for all kinds of things like terrorism, weather, blah, blah, blah. But they didn't have it for communicable diseases.
And they also laid off a bunch of people, if I'm not mistaken, in the immediate aftermath.
Yeah, something like a third of their staff, 50, 60 people, something like that.
So there was internal organizational reluctance on the part of South By to make this big decision. And obviously, that's just one small microcosm of kind of the big picture struggles that individuals and corporations are having about how do their personal and professional responsibilities stack up against their social and civic responsibilities. I think obviously if South By Southwest had not pulled the plug and was somehow allowed to continue, it would be seen as a model of what not to do right now, given what's been happening. Do you get the sense from your conversations with people that internally in the South By organization, the choice to end or to cancel this year's event was ultimately viewed as the right choice, even though there are tremendous costs to it?
Just to be fair here, like, I don't know exactly what was happening in the room there.
Yeah.
And I think that to be fair to the South by Southwest people, when they were under all of this pressure, we were at a different phase of all of this. As I recall, the entire state of Texas had a very small number of cases. There was nothing in the immediate area of Austin. And, you know, even in New York, I remember we were in like single digits of people who had been tested positive. And I think that we were all getting all kinds of misinformation from all sources about just what was happening. So I do think that that was the point where like there were storm clouds on the horizon and it wasn't really clear what anybody should do. You know, I think that they were the canary in the coal mine about a lot of this. I don't want to criticize them for the decisions that were not made. I just think that their experience was the thing that really showed the rest of this industry and a lot of the rest of the world just what life was going to be like.
If I'm not mistaken, there was a similar calculus in terms of internal conversations versus public and health department conversations vis-a-vis Coachella and Stagecoach. Also, I think there was at least one or two cases that had already been identified in the kind of Indio area prior to the cancellation of Coachella or the postponement, I'm sorry, of Coachella. So from your conversations with them, do you get the sense that they saw what happened with South by Southwest and kind of accepted that this is what was going to happen? Or did they also, did Coachella and Golden Voice also sort of wait for guidance or pressure from health officials?
I think it's probably a little of both. I think, you know, they knew that the pressure was upon them. And I can only imagine that they were coming under pressure from artists at that point. And in Riverside County, California, which is where the event takes place, it was a very similar situation with the health department there, where there was an announcement that, again, like all systems are go for all big events. And they're talking about Coachella there. And then I think that was on a Friday. And then over the weekend, the county announced the first case of coronavirus in their county. And then the second case and the third case. And within days, again, there was a decision by the local health officials. I don't know what was happening between Golden Voice and the government officials there. But I think that for a lot of reasons, it makes a lot of sense for these promoters and the people organizing these festivals and tours to wait for the guidance from the authorities or for them to like make the order. There may be insurance reasons for doing that. This is a very complicated area, and it all gets down to, you know, exactly what is covered in these like huge insurance policies. Right now, we know a bit about what's in a typical policy. But when you talk about an event like Coachella, it's not typical.
You know, I was reading some stuff online about how basically up until, say, the second week of January, insurers were adding coronavirus onto policies. So you could pay to have that added onto a policy. But at a certain point, that option was taken off the table, I believe, because insurers did not want to be on the hook for that. So you have companies like Golden Voice and South By who are on the hook for untold amounts of money. And I think you're right. The order in which decisions are made is probably at least in part driven by the needs of insurance or how best to be made whole, if it's possible to be made whole.
I think this was also part of what was going on with the Live Nation AEG mm-hmm. postponements of tours, them just taking everything basically off the road. I do think that that was a very sincere move to protect people, and that they realized that like the writing is on the wall here. They had to do something. But I also think that insurance is part of the game there. And it's, I think it's very telling that what we're seeing from most of these tours is postponement. And there's just this, like, we're taking it off the road. We're postponing. Watch this space for more information. If they postpone a tour, they don't have to refund tickets.
Right.
And for insurance purposes, it's still...
It's an active event, basically.
Yes, it's an active event. And so usually what happens with a tour is Ticketmaster or whoever sells the tickets, holds the millions of dollars in escrow, and then nothing happens until the event actually takes place. The event takes place, that's when the parties are paid and so forth. So as long as it's an active event, it's not canceled, there's a question of it may go on at some point in the future. It may be 6 months. It may be a year. That's not actually super uncommon. I remember The Who with a big tour a couple years ago. Roger Daltrey was ill. They put a bunch of shows on sale. I'm sure they sold tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars of tickets, maybe. And then they postponed it. And many of those dates didn't take place until like a year and a half later. What's really unusual is that you know, you don't have 40 tours doing this at the same time.
Sure. And I hadn't really thought of the logistics of basically the money transferring, right? Like the idea that Ticketmaster is fundamentally an escrow holder for stakeholders in concerts, be it Live Nation or artists, you know, Live Nation AEG promoters or the artists themselves. So I'm sure, number one, they want to restore public faith. They want to be like, this, we will come back. You will see your Billie Eilish tour. Don't worry about it. Everything's going to be fine. That's part of it. And also, I'm sure that they don't want to return all the money that's in escrow for fear that they may not get it back if they cancel and announced a brand new tour 6 months from now, 12 months from now, or whatnot. You already have hundreds of millions of dollars in hand. Returning that money probably feels like a non-starter, I've got to assume.
Yeah, but it's not quite as simple as that. I mean, that's the big picture of the ticketing. But if you're a company like Live Nation, part of what you do every day is you pay advances to artists who are going to go on tour. And you say to, you know, Superstar X, we're going to pay you $50 million and we're going to basically buy your entire tour or X number of shows. And then, you know, we'll collect everything that comes in. And it's, you know, it's an advance against royalties or a income stream kind of a thing. And so on the one hand, they're paying that out. On the other hand, literally their other arm is Ticketmaster collecting the revenue. Ticketmaster has to hold it. So for Live Nation and Ticketmaster, which is one company, they do have a situation there where like they may have paid out huge amounts of money to artists to book them for a tour, and then they sold the tickets, but they can't collect the money yet. Live Nation was hit really, really hard in the stock market the last week or so, along with everybody else. But I think the day after they postponed the tours, they were hit much harder than anybody else. And I think that's all the big investors that own that stock saying, what is going to happen here in the next 6 months? There's also the question of like the trickle down effect of the economics of all of this.
Let's talk about fallout through a couple of different lenses. Not Fallout Boy, although TBD. Let's talk about a few different angles on this. One, artists who are either mid-tour or about to set up their tour, about to head out on the road. That's number one. Spring is usually you get the first trickles of the big summer tours. That's number one. Then let's talk about the second layer economy around tours, which is to say audio engineers and merchandise salespeople and roadies and guitar techs and all these people who every year are making their living kind of on the backs of big artist tours. But let's start with the artists themselves. Financially, how does this compromise someone, you know, let's say at a Billie Eilish level, let's say at a Rage Against the Machine level, someone who's doing a big arena tour. Let's start there.
It's massive. Over the last like 20 years, there's been a complete reversal of the economics between selling records and touring for artists. It used to be that touring didn't make that much money and you made the money on the record sale. And we all know what happened, right? You know, the record industry completely cratered and then came back through streaming. But even if you're a Billie Eilish and you're getting hundreds of millions of streams, those hundreds of millions of streams are worth less money than selling 10 million records. And you're going to make a huge portion of your money on the road. Now, realistically, if you're somebody at the level of Billie Eilish, a huge superstar of the moment, she has all kinds of opportunities available to her. And she's going to take a hit from this. She's going to take a hit. But I think she's going to be okay, is the general perception. The Rolling Stones just canceled their tour. I think they're going to be okay.
Ben, they got to sell one of the houses in the south of France. Just one.
Yes, exactly. Just one.
The other seven they can keep. That's no problem. In the spirit of the Rolling Stones and their ongoing financial tensions, potentially owing to tour cancellation, let's listen to a little bit of what you might have caught on that tour. Let's hear You Can't Always Get What You Want.
I saw her today at the reception. A glass of wine in her hand. I knew she was gonna meet her connection. At her feet was a footloose man. You can't always get what you want. You can't always get what you want. You can't always get what you want. But if you try sometimes, well, you might find.
Where it starts to get really hairy is further down the chain. And we still don't really know. I mean, like, this is so unprecedented. At what level does this become ruinous for artists?
Ruinous is exactly the word, because I've noticed that this comes up a lot, and I'm sure you've encountered a version of this, you know, over your years of writing. But I feel like there has generally been a presumption that if you are an indie musician in whatever genre, but who is successful enough or lauded enough to get coverage in, you know, a place like the New York Times or Rolling Stone or Spin or Pitchfork or whatnot, there's a kind of abstract presumption that that artist is doing well financially, like somehow it goes hand in hand. But what I know and what you know and what many of us know is that there is almost no correlation sometimes between the amount of exposure an artist gets, especially indie artists, and their financial stability. I mean, I remember, I think it was Vulture last year or the year before did a thing where they talked to 20 or so indie musicians about their day jobs. And they just had all these like different kinds of day jobs. And it was very matter of fact and to the point. These are people who already had to subsidize their artistic lives with some other kind of stable or quasi-stable employment. Here we are in a situation where you've removed live ticket revenue, which for an artist like that can be the primary, the only way they're staying afloat, or they're self-funding their tours. So this is getting to the point where I'm seeing a lot of young musicians ask for Patreon donations, obviously pointing people to their Bandcamp because they get a good percentage of the money that is spent on Bandcamp, pushing merch sales. I saw someone today doing an online concert and charging tickets to an online concert. You're going to start to see all these kind of innovative ways to make up for the shortfall. But at the same time, what it really emphasizes to me is just how fragile that ecosystem is.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think the kind of things that we're seeing right now about Patreon and buy my merch, there's desperation in it. And, you know, we don't know how well that's going to work. I mean, merch is part of the live music economy. Part of what happens is you play the gig and you try to get to buy your t-shirts and vinyl and, you know, stickers and whatever. And like that is vastly reduced if you're not on the road. Will people still buy it online? Will they see the tweet? You know, will they bother to check your Facebook feed? We don't know. Will they bother to do this online streaming event that you're doing? It's all a question mark.
And also there's a glut. I mean, look, one of the things about going to a concert, it's like Tuesday night, that's what I'm doing. I cleared my schedule. I know from 8 p.m. to midnight, I'm going to be at such and such a room watching such and such a performer. But imagine looking at Instagram and being like, wow, 20 of my favorite musicians are asking for something right now. They're in a bad way and they need help. Then that sort of ethical responsibility of fandom really becomes a thing, because you're like, well, I want to support these people. These are musicians or creative people who have created work that is meaningful to me. And yet it is a glut. And I wonder at what point people who are already feeling vulnerable because of what's happening out in the rest of the world are going to say, ah, it's too much.
It's one more plea in your social feed, and it's going to get mixed in with the public broadcasting and the environmental and the, you know, animal rights requests that you're also getting. You know, whoever you are, you're getting all kinds of pleas in your social media feed for people looking for money, asking you to buy things, check this out. The thing about live music that has been highlighted, I think, so much in the internet age and the age of social media, it is that it's this moment of sanctuary. And it's like, it's you communing with other people in real life, seeing the music on stage. And so, yeah, as you said, like, you clear your calendar, you go, you experience it, and the merch commemorates that experience.
Exactly.
You know, if you're buying merch from Instagram, is it commemorating how you're sitting at home scrolling through Instagram? How long does that feeling of guilt and obligation continue, where people say, I'm buying the merch because I love my band and I don't want them to suffer more? It's only been a week. It's only been a few days even right now. So we're seeing a lot of that, but this entire disruption of the concert business, this could go on for 6 months. This could go on for the rest of the year. We don't know.
And to your point, again, I keep returning to the word ruinous. And I'm thinking, you know, when we come out of the other side of this, whenever that is, at the same way, we're going to look at the restaurants in our neighborhood that closed and were not able to reopen. And the same way that we're going to look at musicians or artists or other creative fields and say, well, there's some percent of that field. There was a shrinkage. And those people are not going to continue their work in that creative field. This band could not survive the storm. This musician, this violin player, this drummer had to make choices in order to sustain their financial stability, and they are not going to come back. So I think we're going to look back in 6 months or a year and almost be able to identify and name and say, well, we lost this in the coronavirus crisis. We lost that band. We lost this musician. And I don't mean obviously death. I mean the creative output. And I think we're not there yet, but I fear that that's where we're getting to 2-3 months from now.
But I think the restaurants are eventually going to come back. Like, the demand for food will be there. But once the struggling musician just makes the decision to throw in the towel because they can't make a living and they do something else, I don't think a lot of them are going to come back. I think there will be, as you said, a loss that happens here. It's really sad just to think of, like, what is that going to look like?
And again, these are fragile ecosystems to start with. And I feel like sometimes we don't spend enough time in our work, whether it's on podcast or in our writing, we don't emphasize kind of how fragile these systems are. They seem like they're so structured and they're so seamless, but we know how fragile they are. And this is an event that is primed to crack a system that already was kind of like being held together with spit and glue. That's really worrisome. And part of these fragile ecosystems are all these people who are not musicians, the people who are part of the music touring industry specifically, and also the music business more broadly, whose livelihoods depend on a stable touring ecosystem. Ben, you just wrote a piece touching on this. So can you kind of talk us through who you talked to and what you learned over the last couple of days of reaching out to folks?
I tried to get a sense of the economic impact on all of the people whose livelihoods depend on concert tours, but who are not artists. So, you know, we call it the crew, you know, the road crew is the way you think of it, but it's quite a complex and in-depth ecosystem. I mean, one level, it is the roadies, it is the person doing the lighting and the sound, but there's also the transportation, there's the hospitality, there's the merch sales, there's the marketing, there's, you know, the agents and promoters even. But I try to focus on the people who are on tour with the artists, riding in the buses, going from show to show, and what the impact is on them. And this is as one source told me, this is the original gig economy. This is a huge labor pool. I actually don't know quantitatively how many people are employed here or how much money overall is at stake, because this is generally mostly a non-unionized workforce, a non-salaried workforce. These are freelancers who are hired tour to tour. A bunch of these people told me, you know, they don't really know what's on the calendar work-wise for themselves beyond a few months, maybe 6 months for the more higher level and experienced ones.
And that's in the best of times.
That's in the best of times. That's, you know, the last, you know, 10 years that they've been on the road when everything has been raging. And there's been a lot of work to go around, you know, as in these have been boom years for live music until this moment right now. So it's a job that is filled with uncertainty. And as long as there's money coming in the door and the trucks are on the road, it's okay. But the minute that stops, all of those people were sent home. One of the people I talked to is a young guy who's been on the road with Kiss as a lighting technician. And they're doing their, you know, quote unquote, farewell tour. It's playing at arenas. And they were in Tulsa, Oklahoma last Thursday. And they were set to do a show. And then that's when all the tours were pulled. Kiss was a Live Nation tour. So last few dates of the tour were postponed. This guy was put on a bus, sent home, job over.
To emphasize, they are paid gig to gig. I know one or two musicians who salary their band and crew, maybe partially to insure against events like this, partially to make sure they get to work with the people they want to work with. But I know that that's a model that some musicians employ. But I would venture to say that a lot of musicians do not employ that. Overwhelming majority musicians hire gig to gig, specifically as a means of expense control. So they're leaving their people, even their loyal people who year after year come back to work on their tour 2 months out of the year, 3 months of the year. Those loyal people are just as in the lurch as the kind of super vulnerable people who jump from gig to gig to gig with different musicians.
Yeah. And one thing I did learn is that there really is a lot of complexity in the hierarchy and the whole chain of different jobs here. Some people may be employed by the artist or by their management company.
Yeah.
But many of them may work for like an outside vendor. And so the band, you know, hires various other companies to do things. There's also people that are on the more like venue level of things. There are people like photographers yeah. who may be, you know, paid for the work that they do, but may not actually be employed. And I don't want to speak out of school there, but I think one thing I've realized about this is that it's a very complex economy there. And so people may have all kinds of different arrangements to get paid. But pretty much all of that has been put on hold.
Okay, so before we wrap up our chat, I'm wondering where you're looking to, especially in the next, say, 2 to 3 weeks, what are the pressure points that you're going to be paying the most attention to? Because I feel like, I mean, I don't want to speak out of turn, but I feel like the catastrophic event has happened as far as the business goes, which is to say tours are postponed, events are not happening, people are not allowed to congregate. That's one small part of the broader crisis that we're dealing with in our country. But those pressure points have passed, at least, or at least they've been initiated already. Are there upcoming pressure points that you're mindful of as you're going to be reporting? Because I know this is going to be a heavy part of your reporting, you know, for the coming weeks.
Well, not to give away too many trade secrets here, but I mean, I think of like what just happened as like when Wile E. Coyote like skids off the edge of the cliff and he's like hovering in midair for a second and then he falls. And like where we are right now is like he just blinked in midair and realized he's going to fall to the bottom of the canyon. And so we don't know what happens when he falls to the bottom of the canyon. And I think like that's what, unfortunately, like that's what we need to keep an eye on. We need to keep an eye on how this actually does impact artists, how it actually does impact the crews, even record labels. You know, I think it's going to have an impact on all of that. I mean, the music industry has shifted so dramatically towards streaming, and we're all like sitting in our sweatpants streaming, you know, TV and music all the time now because of this. And so, you know, like Lil Uzi Vert just went to number one with a huge number of streams. So on the one hand, that wasn't affected much by the slowdown in touring, but it's all interconnected. And a lot of what happens with planning an album now is what's the tour going to do? That relationship used to be the opposite. It used to be, how do we just get them on the road to get people to buy the album? And now a lot of cases it's let's time the album to the tour so that we can move a lot of tickets and throw some, you know, download codes in with that. And there's already chatter about how that's going to affect things.
Yeah, it's been on my mind because so I have a piece coming out this week, which I won't say who it's about because it won't be out, I don't think, when this episode comes out. But it'll be clear in a couple of days, who has an album coming out, say, I think 2 weeks from now. Right. And I think that's still within the time window where you've done most of your run up to your promo. And it would be weird if you all of a sudden bumped your album, you know, 2 months or 3 months or 4 months. But I feel like if I was a musician and I was planning on releasing an album right now in, you know, say May to June, and there were some potential tour dates attached to that, I feel like maybe I'm starting to second guess. And I'm second guessing, obviously, the tour dates because of what's happening. But I'm also second guessing, what does it mean to drop an album kind of into this ocean of who knows what, especially if it's not immediately pegged to a tour? I feel like you're going to start to see some retrenchment. I think you'll see the normal release calendar as we know what it's going to be for the next 2-3 weeks. I think you'll see that. And then I think you're going to see like a big kind of ocean of question mark.
You know, nature abhors a vacuum.
Yes. And well, like, that's you just,
you know, got, yeah, one yeah. thing about music now that's so amazing is just that people come out of nowhere.
Well, this like, is, I have one word.
Maybe Rihanna. The next
Mil Teca, you know? No. I have Rihanna. I think what's going to happen in April or May, you're going to see a Rihanna record. Maybe you'll see a Beyonce record. Like, you're going to see a record from someone, and I don't mean this in a crass way. If anything, I mean it in kind of a charitable way, who understands the seriousness of the moment and who has a relationship with their fans and with the internet where they are perceived as like giving gifts of their music and their presence. I can see people at that level saying, you know what? Now is the time. Now is the time to put something. All ears will be on me, and I can provide something that will be healing and enjoyable to millions of people.
That's probably true. But I think we might very well be seeing another Old Town Road happen. TikTok memes haven't stopped.
Sure.
People are sitting around on their phones, and young, hungry artists are screwing around and making music, and things are going to blow up. And we're not going to see it coming. But it'll happen. And so in a way that's a good thing, that maybe the clearing of the calendar will give more room for like the next left field star to emerge.
I'm with it. Quick question before you go, Ben, what color are your sweatpants that you're working from home in?
They're denim. They're denim sweatpants.
Oh my God. Okay. mine are like kind of a royal blue. Just if anybody was wondering, they're hot in Copenhagen. Ben, thank you for taking a break from your reporting to check in with us. And stay strong. Wash your hands, okay?
Thanks, Ben. Take care.
Okay, home office interlude, John Caramonica storage unit inventory. So let's look around. There's a couple interesting things here. You guys may know who Jim Walrod was. Jim Walrod was a historian and collector of contemporary design and furniture, passed away a couple years ago. I bought a shelf, and it turned out it was an IKEA shelf, LOL, covered in a Memphis print that he had, and I bought it at auction, and I still have not hung it up. So that's here in my office, standing, leaning against the bookcase. There's a lot of books. We'll get into some of the books on later episodes. But what I really want to talk about is I like merch. This maybe will not come as a surprise to you. If you haven't listened to the merch episode, I highly recommend listening to the merch episode. Brian Brossell was on it, Amelia Petrarca, Lauren Schlossman, real, real big episode talking about the explosion in music merch and the value of old music merch. I have a lot of eBay alerts for specific artists, and I really like Brooks and Dunn, 90s power country. Should we listen to some Brooks and Dunn? Yeah, I think we should listen to some Brooks and Dunn. Yo, let's play a little bit of Boot Scootin' Boogie. A little OG Brooks and Dunn, if you know, you know.
me past the city limit sign, where there's a honky-tonk near the county line. The joint starts jumping every night when the sun goes down. They got whiskey, women, music and smoke. It's where all the cowboy folk go to boot scoot boogie. I got a good job, I work hard for my money. When it's quitting time, I hit the door running. I fire up my pickup truck and let the horses run. I go flying down that highway to that hideaway, stuck out in the woods to do the boot scoot boogie.
Okay, so Brooks and Dunn merch, as far as like t-shirts and tour merch, not particularly great. That, or at least not the ones that I've encountered. I was at a spot at Nashville recently that had kind of a good older shirt with like a lightning motif, and that's kind of what we're going to talk about. I want to get to that in a second. What I have here is a Brooks and Dunn rodeo tour jacket. It's kind of like, what's it like? It's like sort of like a baseball jacket. You know, it's got some elastic around the waist. It's got elastic at the collar. And what's interesting about this is on the back, it's embroidered. You know, it's got a chain stitched Brooks and Dunn logo, which is really great. But the overwhelming majority, that's on a black backdrop. And the black is on the top half of the jacket. But on the bottom half of the jacket, front and back, and the sleeves are all kind of like a quasi Pendleton fabric. It's not as heavy as a Pendleton. It's more just kind of a generic Southwestern / Native American print. But this jacket is like very visually intense. The cut's a little weird. I don't think I've ever worn it out of the house, if I'm being completely honest. But it was something I found on eBay a while ago that I thought looked beautiful and I wanted to have in my collection. That said, you really want to know where the Brooks and Dunn gems are? I feel like I'm giving away one of my secrets here, but, you know, we're all homebound. Crazy things are happening. Okay, I want you to go to eBay and search Brooks and Dunn Panhandle Slim. Panhandle Slim is a maker of Southwest and Western themed shirts and clothing. They did a line with Brooks and Dunn. I believe it was in the 90s. I'm not 100% sure of the provenance, specifically age. I don't know the vintage of this, but these designs, man, these designs will literally blow the top of your head off. They are extremely bold and loud. There are flame prints like you would see on like a, you know, like a hot rod. There's lightning print, which is where I think the t-shirt I saw in Nashville recently, I think it comes from. There are these shirts that are, I'm looking at one right now. It's like beige across the top, white on the bottom. And in the middle, there's like almost like a flip book of images of like rodeo cowboys on horses, just like going across the shirt. Like, I don't know if they're telling a story or not. Here's one. This is actually my favorite. Some of these are, if you're really into kind of like early to mid 80s kind of like neon iconography, these seem very indebted to that kind of style. The one that I love that is the best, and I have never been able to find, I've only seen pictures of it. It's purple at the top and it's white at the bottom. And the line separating the purple from the white is all like jagged and broken. It looks like small pieces of the purple are, it's almost like Tetris. They're almost like falling into the white. And having tried on some of these shirts over the years, the cut of these shirts is not suited for me. I don't know who it's suited for. Maybe a rodeo cowboy, not your boy. That said, I would absolutely wear the mess out of that shirt if I ever found it in an XL. Anyway, if you want a good distraction in these trying times, Brooks and Dunn Panhandle Slim. And if you buy one of these shirts and you wear it successfully, send me a fit pic, popcast@nytimes.com. Now that we've had our fashion excursion for the day, we are going to put the things back on the shelves and back on the racks and call in with John Pareles, chief pop music critic in the New York Times. JP, what's good?
Self-isolation. Are you lonely tonight?
Oh, I mean, well, always, TBH. Quarantunes, big energy for this week. JP, first of all, just as a quick sidebar, we had a Google Hangout meeting the other day. You have a very robust CD collection. I know you are not hurting for music in this particular time. I'm aware. I respect it. As a fellow absorber of many things, I respect it. Just want to put that out there. JP, I wanted to talk briefly, because it's a very big topic, but briefly about pop music in times of crisis. And I was thinking about this in kind of two different ways. One, sort of moments of upheaval, political upheaval and social upheaval, and two, kind of maybe something a little bit more positive, like what pop stars tend to do in reaction to moments like this in terms of musical. So when you think of the current situation, does it bring to mind any earlier moments that you've been through or that you remember particularly vividly pop music wise?
Well, actually, it brings to mind a new dynamic, something that's opposite from what we've seen before. I mean, the reaction to 9/11, which you also experienced, was a big concert at Madison Square Garden with all the first responders coming on stage and English pop stars like The Who and Paul McCartney joining Americans to show solidarity. It was a gathering. It was a big public gathering in a public space saying, you know, we're going to be together in this room and we're going to make this statement that we're showing solidarity. You can't do that now. And previous consciousness raising, money raising things like Live Aid, which was a big concert in Philadelphia and a big concert in England broadcast worldwide, was again a gathering of people, was this giant social event. And now we're facing something different, which is this isolated situation where everybody's alone in their workspaces.
Yeah. And that is, you know, I know you've been thinking a lot this week about kind of the role that concerts play in public life and in people's kind of personal healing journeys.
And in the way music is shaped, too, in the way that audiences train performers. You don't get that if you're sitting at home playing into your podcast microphone.
Right. Although one thing that I've been thinking about kind of hand in hand with what you're talking about are kind of the way that social media, the internet, you know, certainly Instagram, TikTok, Triller, apps like that kind of reframe community. Because what I see, we think of a concert, we think of everybody gathering in one space to hear one person. When I look on those apps, I see people, everybody in their own room, already isolated. Everybody's already isolated.
They're preparing for this.
But in dialogue with hundreds or tens or dozens or thousands of other kids or people. And so it's unusual to have such a dominant platform for creativity that actually is almost premised upon isolation. It demands a kind of isolation. And that's a change. We haven't seen that before.
Yeah, it's the difference between real-time solidarity and a kind of chain reaction, virality, you might call it.
Ba-dum-bum.
And in some way, all of these social media apps anticipated this. It's like, how are you going to be alone in your room connecting to the world?
I don't think it was designed with an issue like this in mind.
Since we're all in the simulation, it probably was designed for that.
I've lost track of which simulation we're in. I don't know, like version 6.0. I don't even know anymore. We are increasingly atomized because of the type of social distancing that happens because of increased connectivity. It's much it's easy to reach people now, so it's not less necessary to see people than it used to be. And that has trickled into culture, too. Like, we've seen culture predicated upon this kind of socializing emerge, especially in the last 2 or 3 years. But I, like you, also think that real-time communion has a space.
Yeah, I mean, it's a different kind of thing. In person, there's peer pressure. There's that weird and wonderful feeling when you're in a crowd and suddenly just like a wave of unity sweeps through the room.
Yeah.
I mean, you felt that at concerts.
Of course.
You know, it doesn't have to be a big sing-along. It can just be this electric moment. And instead, what you get with the social media apps is kind of like a chain of dominoes. I mean, which is a different kind of momentum, which is, you know, one falling after the other, but not that same kind of physical alchemical thing, more like hitting a like button.
Right, which is not a substitute, not a worthy substitute. I was thinking about how this current moment felt. And you mentioned 9/11 before, and it's been on my mind specifically, obviously the events, the traumas are very different, but it's been on my mind with that sense of kind of not knowing where to go, not knowing exactly what the correct next step or even what was permitted or allowed. And I feel like what we're all going to be navigating in the coming days and weeks is some version of that. But, you know, in this moment, I mean, 9/11 is pre-streaming, you know, it's a very different music ecosystem. So we're set up differently now. You know, some important records were actually released on 9/11. You know, Jay-Z's Blueprint,
right?
For my world, Fabulous's Ghetto Fabulous, very, very important record from that time. You could go to record stores, but not every record store, because certainly in New York, certain stores were closed. You had to go seek things out. Whereas now, I think any artist who releases something in the next week or two will have a pretty captive audience to release it to.
True.
I wanted to also talk about kind of what pop stars could do. You know, when I was talking to Cesario earlier in the episode, I said I wouldn't be surprised if you ended up with like a big Rihanna record or a big Beyonce record or something, you know, a Drake record, like something coming, kind of coming out of nowhere from a major pop star. But you and I have both lived through multiple eras of multi-pop star charity singles, right? I'm thinking, Do They Know It's Christmas? I'm thinking, We Are the World.
There comes a time when we heed a certain call, when the world must come together as one. There are people dying, oh, when it's time to lend a hand to life, the greatest gift of all. We can go on pretending day by day that someone somewhere will soon make a change. We are all a part of God's great big family.
And the truth, you know, love is all we need.
Tell me a little bit about those songs and what role they played, broadly speaking, in the culture at the time of their release.
Philosophically, rhetorically, both of those songs really grated on me. We aren't the world, you know,
right?
We, you know, privileged American pop stars aren't the world. Do they know it's Christmas in Ethiopia? Some of them are Muslims.
Yeah.
You know, it was this real like first world obliviousness in both of those songs. We Are the World is a wonderful piece of music, you know, take away the smugness of it and it feels good and uplifting. But I wasn't a big aesthetic fan of those songs. On the other hand, they raised a lot of money. They gave people a feeling that they were participating. I don't know if you get the same feeling of participation from a viral video or from putting your spin on some dance moves that are five people down the chain of transmission. It's not the same as sharing.
Do you sense an opportunity here, though, for something roughly equivalent to those things?
I've actually seen some pretty cool TikToks already. There's an African group, I think South African, doing a dance in not a little too close quarters, but, you know, doing a dance with like wash your hands and don't panic.
Right.
I mean, people are seizing the opportunity to get those messages out like public service announcements. But what would you do with a whole gaggle of giant pop stars? I mean, you couldn't put them together in a room because you can't put them together in a room. I guess you could make it a montage. I mean, somebody may do it.
But think of the We Are the World video where you had kind of like all those cutaway shots in the video of like Lionel Richie or Bruce Springsteen or whoever, like just like really emoting on their three word part. You could do that. Like you have a video where like you had everybody doing a version of that, either sure, on their Instagram or on TikTok, and then someone on the back end, like stitching it all into something quasi-coherent. I don't know at this point where the funds go. Do the funds go to coronavirus research? Do they go to testing? Does it go to supporting people who've been rendered jobless or are struggling with medical bills? That I don't know. But I wonder is there an opportunity here for pop music to try to step up and do something rather than accept, hey, I'm isolated, I'm stuck at home, Drake's playing basketball and sipping champagne, rather than accept that. And that's really what he's doing on his Instagram story. That's like, you know, so rather than accept that as the norm, is there an opportunity for something big? Or was that kind of charity single, and those are both from the mid-1980s, is that reflective of a kind of monoculture that kind of like doesn't quite exist anymore?
Well, who would you put together? I mean, would there be multiple versions? Would there be a hip-hop version? Would there be a country version? Would you put the country guys with the hip-hop guys?
Yes. Well, to be honest, I think what they should do is they should read my piece from the end of last 2 years ago about the new pop 2.0. So it should be a pop 2.0 mega mix. I want to hear Bad Bunny and Drake and Sam Hunt and Ozuna and Lil Baby. And BTS and NCT 127. I want to hear everybody on the same path. And then Taylor Swift can release an acoustic cover of it.
I sense a plan here.
That's what I would like to do. Okay, so I'm just throwing that out in the world. If anybody's listening, free idea. Let me know if you want to make it happen. JP, thank you for calling in, and we shall get through this. I hope that you are washing your hands and digging deep into your archive and finding something interesting to listen to.
I am indeed. Good to talk to you. Good to talk to anybody at this point.
Yeah, true story. Big facts.
See you next time.
That's our show this week. First show from the home office. Thank you to Ben Cesario and John Perellis for calling in and taking time. And a little earlier than normal, thank you to Pedro Rosado from Hepstepper Media, who is spearheading this from his house. Really grateful for everybody today. Listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. You can email us always at podcast@nytimes.com. Also, the Facebook group is jumping. I'm very excited. People are out here just really having a good conversation. It's incredibly good spirited. Join the Facebook group, the NY Times podcast Facebook group, and hang out with a bunch of other people who care about music as much as we do and as much as you do. And subscribe to podcasts anywhere you get your audio content: iHeartRadio, Google Play, Stitcher, iTunes, et cetera, et cetera. We will be here. We will be back actually again later this week and next week. We are not going anywhere. I want to go out while we are talking about charity singles. And I can already feel through the wires, I can feel Pedro retching right now. So we talked about We Are the World. We talked about Do They Know It's Christmas? The 80s were a wild time. If you were not there, a lot of madness happening in the 80s. There was this thing that happened called Hands Across America, which you guys may not be up on, or you maybe are.
Oh, my God.
Yes, that's right. Tap in, Pedro. Tap in. Hands Across America was, I wish I could even tell you what it was, but for some reason, me, my parents, we went and we held hands with a bunch of strangers under, I want to say, the West Side Highway, thousands and thousands of strangers. And, you know, people were holding hands all across the country. I almost don't even want to Google to remember what the charitable cause was. But anyway, it was called Hands Across America. And if you're asking,
John, was there a song to go with this mass grouping of people doing a very nice thing, by the way?
Boy, was there. So as we go out today, I want to celebrate something that we cannot do with social distancing. But I want to remember a time when people held hands across America. So we must learn to